Yeah, if you would just kind of fill me in a little bit, briefly about the history of this property and your family.
Sure. Okay. My parents bought the original property in 1956, and the tasting room is on the south edge of it. And it was 120 acres. Had some vineyard on it. It had some missions, golden chasselas, muscat, some Zinfandel. Had about 2 acres of cherries, some prunes. And my dad was a dentist at the time, but he always wanted a ranch. So I know he told me when I was little that he hoped that the grapes would pay for the property taxes. That was about it. Of course, Zins were about $50 a ton. That was the most valuable of the varieties that we had. And the golden chasselas and the muscats, I think, were 25. All the whites were 25. And my dad sold them all to Segacio. Segacio basically made a lot of bulk wine in those days and sold it to Gallo. They didn't have their own label. They crushed a lot of their own, and then they bought around, and they were basically a bulk winery. And around 1964, my father was fortunate enough to have Pam's father as a patient, and he was Paul Heck from Corbell. And most of the vineyards here were old. They didn't want the missions anymore. And so my dad was thinking about pulling some of the stuff out, and he asked Pam's dad what to plant. And he said, well, I think you ought to plant some Pinot and some Chardonnay. They're coming in. And so, and Paul was a very good friend of Carl Winty. And so he said, I'll call Carl, and you go down, and he'll give you some budwood. And so that's how my dad got the original budwood. He got it from Carl Winty, and he did 6 acres of each. This is the 6 acres of Chardonnay that he did up here. We still have 4 acres of it left. And then we did 6 acres of Pinot up on the hill. Of course, it was all on St. George. It was field-budded. And I remember the first couple of years we were still selling Segacio, and they really didn't know what to do with this stuff because when the first couple of years it came into production, they hadn't heard of these varieties because they were used to to a lot of French Colombard was growing around here, a lot of Chenin Blanc, mm-hmm. of course the Zinfandel, Petit Sirah, mm-hmm. Carignan. That's pretty much what they did. And to be honest, a lot of that stuff they didn't keep separate. It just kind of went in. They had the old winery there in town. They had enormous cement tanks, and it was all covered with a roof, and you could walk down the middle, and one side was red. I think if you were facing west, the right side was reds, the left side was whites, and you could walk along the top of these tanks, and of course the reds all had the skins on top, and they'd form these little volcanoes, you know, and then the juice would bubble out. The whites had no skins, and so they'd form giant bubbles. And I can just remember going up there as a kid. And those were back in the days when most people picked in prune boxes, because that's what they had. I mean, we went from prunes to grapes, mm-hmm. so you basically were dumping prune boxes.
That's right.
We hauled it in prune boxes, dumped it on a conveyor, old wood conveyor with wood slats. Everything was steel and painted in those days, no stainless.
I remember that. Yeah.
And God knows how much of the paint ended up in the wine. all big basket presses. That's the way they did it.
Yeah.
There were no bladder presses. And so, anyway, that's how he got started. And then, actually, my dad gives Rod Strong a lot of credit because Rod came up here, and I think Rod had a wine shop in Belvedere at that time.
Right. That Peter Friedman helped.
And he was with Peter Friedman,
right.
too.
Mm-hmm.
But he came up here and he wanted to, he came out and he came around and he started to buy fruit, and he really upped the price. I mean, we went from in the 50s, 75 to, you know, a few hundred bucks a ton for Chardonnay and Pinot because there wasn't much of it around, and he
right.
was looking for it. And he started crushing down at the old Windsor facility. And, I can remember going down there and with my dad, bringing the grapes down there, and Rod actually was there, and he was dumping them into the crusher in the first you know, those first few years when he was getting going. And then things just kind of went from there. I don't really remember. I can remember now I can't think of his name. Very famous. The winemaker that made the grapes, the Paris tasting wine.
Mike Gergich.
I can remember Mike coming up to my parents' house and buying the Chardonnay, and we still had one block of old head prune Zin right around the house, and he loved that Zin. He wanted that Zin so bad. And he'd go out and taste the fruit, and he wanted to make, but I don't know whether it was they weren't making Zin or it just wasn't in the program. But he felt, we finally tore it out and planted Chardonnay in there. He felt pretty bad about that. But he bought the Chardonnay just that one year, along with some Chardonnay from Dick and one other person. And that was kind of an odd deal because we brought it there that one year. And the next year he called up and he said, we're not going to buy any more Sonoma County fruit. The owners want to do everything Napa. So, you know, and of course the wine hadn't gone to Paris at that point.
Right.
It was just the next year. And so it's kind of funny. And then he did. He called my mom and he said, you know, and told her about that there was going to be a little article in Time magazine about it, and that you know, this wine had gone to Paris and won the Paris tasting. So that's that kind of story. And we never did sell fruit back to Chateau Montelena ever again. That was the only time.
I
suppose it was true of Dick, too, because Ron Dick was from Alexander Valley. And
right.
They basically didn't want any more Sonoma County fruit. And Ron Dick was the biggest contributor in tonnage. We were second. And then there was a little bit, I think, from a vineyard in Napa. I don't know, we did sell fruit to Cuvée Son in Napa, so we did continue to sell fruit into Napa, Chardonnay mostly, I think, and I was just growing up at that time. And then my parents did do a little foray into the wine business. We bought stock in what was Souverain then, when the growers bought it from Pillsbury, and we sold fruit up there for a long time, for all the years that the growers were able to hold on to it. Of course, it finally went. We were finally forced to get out and sell it, and we lost our investment on that. And then we did another wine venture with Peter Friedman, and Peter Friedman was right in the beginning there with Rod Strong. I think they worked together at the wine shop that Rod had in Belvedere, and then he had a long-standing relationship with Rod, and he came up with this idea of doing what he called the Grape Maker Series. And he went to he came to us. He went to
Fritz Maytag.
Robert Young, and he's passed away now. One other winery in Carneros. It was Winery Lake, but I can't think of the guy that owned it.
Rene DeRosa.
Mm-hmm. And he did. So he picked that group of vineyards, and he got together with Bill Hambrick, and we started by actually custom crushing at Windsor, and the first wine was made by Marianne Graff. The first Pinot and Chardonnays were made by Marianne Graff, and for that first year, and he did a label for each. All the labels were different; they were all custom for each vineyard, and Robert Young, I think he did Chardonnay and Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
Fritz Maytag was a Cabernet program only for us. He really only wanted to do Chardonnay with us.
But we said, we've got all this Pinot. We've got to sell this Pinot.
Yeah, duh.
So, when was this? What year was this about?
This would have been late 70s, 78, 79 was the first.
Because the 82 and
he goes, well, sweepstakes. I really don't want to do the Pinot, but what I'll do is a joint venture with you. So we did a joint. He bought the Chardonnay, but we did a joint venture for the Pinot, and initially, and then it kind of morphed into the whole thing became a joint venture, and we formed a company called Healdsburg Wine Growers, and we did the Chardonnay and the Pinot with them. I don't know how many years did they do that. I can't remember.
Well, I'm trying to remember the labels.
I know
through
there was
83.
It was through
83,
I think.
Yeah, through 83. That's what I remember.
And then they decided that they didn't want to do it, and they kind of got
dumped
out of it.
The wine.
Well, no, I mean, we did. We weren't too happy with this one aspect of it. We did win the sweepstakes at the Sonoma County Fair with the 82 Chardonnay.
Right.
And he pre-sold most of the wine.
Peter
had. He mm-hmm. pre-sold most of the wine. And the price wasn't real great. And we said, you know, and of course everybody was clamoring for the wine after we won the sweepstakes.
And it was all sold.
And he said, and he'd sold most of it.
I think for $6 a bottle.
Oh,
no, not that low. Yeah. I don't think it was that low, but it was definitely lower.
Yeah.
Than we could have gotten because we couldn't even meet demand. I mean, everybody was clamoring for it. They couldn't find it.
Yeah.
So we were a little disappointed with that. But he honored all the deals. And one of the things that my parents did do, which kind of got us started on this, is because he initially wanted to do the Pinot with us. We had bought this old dairy in 74, and we never did do it. Was there was pollution problems here with the manure and whatnot, which is why they moved, and so we never pursued the dairy with it. But it had a relatively nice building on it. For the milking parlor was a relatively nice building, and cement walls about halfway up, and a good structure. And so my parents had a contractor come in, and we insulated it, put air conditioning into it. I kind of did some internal structural changes to it, and we made the Pinot for the program for the winemaker series for the Batch Gloopy Vineyards dealer. We made that here. We didn't make it here, but we stored it here. We did the barrel aging here, and that kind of helped us out when we decided to start this because we still do the barrel storage here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So. And we store some of the cases here, not all the cases, but enough here to
supply the tasting room that we can run up and get more.
Yeah.
So you know, basically, we've been selling, but all through these years, we've sold a lot of grapes, and we still do. We still sell a lot into Napa, and we have for quite a few years. We sold to Rudd. We sold the old block that went to the Paris tasting block, and some of the other blocks as well. In the past, now they're just taking the Paris tasting block, but we also sell a lot of we sell some fruit to Francesca in Napa. So we still sell a lot of fruit into Napa. We sell Zin to Gott.
You're just talking Chardonnay,
but yeah, the Chardonnay we sell Chardonnay to Francesca, and we sell Pinot, and we sell Chardonnay to Rudd, and then. We sell to a lot of small wine, you know, small lots too.
Really enamored with our Pinot.
We sell
Kirk Vengi.
Okay.
We sell Pinot to mm-hmm. Vengi. Yeah, we sell.
Mm-hmm. He likes our Pinot.
And as far as this particular venture goes, Pam's nephew and Pat Heck's son. Pat Heck was a very good enologist. Worked at Souverain. Worked at Adler Fells, worked at Scott Labs for years, basically going around and solving people's problems. And I think that's one of the reasons. Tyler's a real cleanliness fanatic because his father saw a tremendous amount of winemaking problems come from people not being clean about what they did and fastidious. Yeah. And Tyler's taking that to heart. And he also had, I think, what's been good for him and been and added to his knowledge a great deal is that his father went to school with Mike Martini and I guess Ed Sbraja too.
All into Fresno State.
And so they all socialized together when he was
David
young
Heitz.
And he was David Heitz.
Right.
Denny Martin was around too. And so Tyler was around some really excellent winemakers all his life, and he went around with his dad with these guys, and he soaked up a lot of knowledge from them, and so I think he always wanted to I think from when he was little he probably always wanted to make wine,
mm-hmm.
and so I thought it would be fun. He was at Cal Poly, and he was finishing up his degree. what would that have been? 2001, I guess. No, 2000, I guess.
2001, we did the barrel.
Right, 2001. But he decided that he was going to do an ag business degree with a minor in enology.
And that's what Katie got.
And so he was home, and I said, and I happened to have some pretty nice second crop Pinot. And I said, do you want to make a barrel? And he said, oh, yeah, sure, let's do that. And I just wanted to kind of test the waters and see how interested he'd be in doing this, and because he hadn't quite graduated yet. So I said, okay, I'll pay for whatever you want. And we actually crushed. We went down, rented a little crusher and a little press, and we brought a brand new barrel, and we made one barrel. We picked one bin of fruit. We made one barrel of wine and came back and bottled it. And by then, he'd graduated. And so the next year, we'd been selling some Pinot to Petsy King, some nice stuff, but it was on a piece of property that my parents bought in 1993 down here. It's a 60-acre piece. And we had, it was some young Pinot. I'd taken the wood from the original Wente block. And I sold to Petsy King, and then Petsy King ran out of money. They called up pretty late in the year, and they said, you know, because they told me earlier they were going to buy this fruit. I said, okay. And they called up around sometime in August, and they said, we don't have any money. Can't we're backing out. We're not going to buy this fruit. And it was about 14 tons, and I could not move it. I couldn't find anybody to take it. And so it was a young block. Everybody went, oh, it's young. It's no good. So I said, okay, Ty, I got this stuff. I got this. It's about 14. It was about 13 ton. It ended up. I said, do you want to do this? And he said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. So we made arrangements and we crushed it at
Taft Street.
Mm-hmm. And we couldn't really get what we wanted. We had to do it in a big tank. We had to do it in a 24 ton tank. A lot of things didn't go our way. But he worked tirelessly, and his dad came down and helped him. Especially on the press check and whatnot, when they were pressing it off, they taste. I remember they tasted together, and that's how we kind of started this. And of course, we kind of dived in.
yeah, 2 feet.
We ended up we ended up with 800 cases right off the bat. And
then how are we gonna sell it?
And then how are we gonna sell it?
And course, that was 2002.
That was 2002.
Right.
And. And so then that's kind of how it's gone, and we've tried distribution, with pretty limited success, and so then we finally decided we had to build a tasting room to present these wines.
Yeah.
One of the things about that we kind of sat down when we first started this thing, and I said, you know, most California Pinots, everybody's making them for immediate consumption.
Right.
They've got these Pinots out there. I mean, it's not unusual to find people trying to sell 2010s right now.
There's even
probably some 2011s out.
Yes.
And I said, you know, why don't we try to do something different? Why don't we make ageable wines? And he was all for that. And I have to say, it's cut both ways. It appears to me that if you're French and you make ageable wines, you're celebrated. If you're here in California and you make ageable wines, you can do it with Cabernets. But if you try to make a Pinot Noir that's ageable, people go and they look at it and they go, "Oh my gosh, how come you're trying to sell a 2004 wine? You know, and it's 2007 or 2008. What are you doing there?" So the perception, at least, and near as I can gather, is that California is not supposed to be able to make ageable wines, and nobody expects us to, and they want wines made in a style for immediate consumption. Mm-hmm. Tyler makes one of the ways that you make a wine that will age is the wine has to have structure, mm-hmm. and we do extensive cold soaks prior to fermentation, and he's removing all that tannin at that point in time as long chain tannin. And then starting the fermentation, and we also try to keep the fermentation fairly cool. We try to control it. Pinot can be kind of hard that from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. But he's made some wines that that age very well, and the problem is that when you go out and you try to sell these wines to restaurants and whatnot, they really don't want to put these wines on the list for the most part.
Some do,
but I mean, there isn't a great appreciation for right. well-aged Pinots. Right.
Yeah, but then you get people that come in the tasting room that are fairly new, mm-hmm. wine, and they look at it and then they kind of hesitate, and you go, "Here, taste it," and then they go,
"Yeah," and that you know that's why it's really a hand sell wine. Yeah. It's really a hand sell wine,
yeah.
And now of course we're doing the Zinfandel, and we've done a little bit of Petit Sirah. And he pretty much makes the Zinfandel the same way. We decided that we didn't want to make Zinfandels with RS. We wanted to make dry Zinfandels. Mm-hmm. And again, that's another thing that's cut both ways. The public kind of is used to Zins with residual sugar, and their palate kind of is attracted to that. But if you take that wine and you bring it back in the kitchen of a restaurant and you pour it for a chef, he goes, "Oh my gosh, this is such a fruit friendly wine," mm-hmm. as opposed to something with 1 or 2% residual sugar, which just doesn't go right. well with food. Right. And so they love it.
Right.
It's trying to get the public or whatever to buy it. But when we taste it, when we taste people on it, but again, we do a long cold soak for mm-hmm. the Zin, and then a relatively cool fermentation. And then we usually are in the 15%. I would say it's unusual for us to get up to 16, and then it's fermented dry. There's no RS in it.
Right.
And again, these wines, when people take, and I think one of the disadvantages of having a dry Zin in a tasting room situation is by itself it may not be as appealing as a Zinfandel with residual sugar. With food, it's much better, unless you want to just eat it with
right.
dessert, unless you want to drink it with dessert,
right.
you know, with your chocolate tort. And then we're doing the same thing with the Petit Sirah. The Petit Sirah is kind of selective. We've made it two seasons, and 2008 and 2010?
Yeah.
And we're not making a lot of it. But
now, are these estate grapes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all
they
estate.
Are,
okay.
So.
What vintages of Pinot are you pouring in your tasting room now?
Right now, we are just about to switch over to the 07s, which I have for you there, and the 05s. But this last weekend, we poured the 04 and the 06 vintage together. So
So those are still available?
Yes. And I just, actually, the 04 is one that I poured for you because I do really feel like it's one of the better Pinot vintages, mm-hmm. and Tyler does as well, and it's showing really nice mm-hmm. right now. So it's one of the more favorable vintages that we sell.
Yeah, how many acres of Pinot do you have now in this state?
Let's see. well,
yeah.
let's see. We have on the home ranch. We have 10 acres that I've replanted. I've replanted the original block that my father planted, and I still have a block that my father planted up here it's 4.5 acres that I sell to William Sellium. And it was planted in 68, so it's a little bit newer than the original block, which was 64. But it only does about 3 tons, and it's 4.5 acres. But I sell it to them. They put it into the
West Side Road
neighbors, right. And they like it, and I've kept with it. I don't know how much longer I can keep with it. It's just so full of Utaipa. But that would be the oldest block that we have. And that's another 4.5, but you can hardly even call it acreage. I mean, it's just, you know.
But the Frost Ranch, how much?
The Frost Ranch, let me see.
What is it called?
The Frost Ranch. The Frost owned it, and they were the previous owner, owned it, and we bought it from them in the 90s.
And where is that?
A 60-acre piece. It's right across the road from Booker Dairy.
Okay.
So we have the hillside and a whole acres that goes down.
Okay.
And we grow 6 different clones of Pinot. Bottensville. Well, 5 now.
5.
2 Dijon clones, 777-667, mm-hmm. Bottensville, Wente, and Pomar.
Yeah, we got some, yeah. There's about 22 acres down there. That was a 60-acre piece that my parents bought in 93. And it was, the interesting thing about that ranch is, been in the same family for over 100 years, been in the Frost family. That's why we call it the Frost Ranch.
Yeah.
They had 300 acres out there, down there in total, that ranch had been sold to Gallo for time immemorial. Even when we bought it, it was still going to Gallo in '93, and they had a lot of they had Sauvignon Vert, a lot of Colombard, and they had 22 acres of Zin Pet mix. And it was true. It was just mixed all over. It was 22 acres.
This is in the 90s still?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, and it all went to down to the Windsor Co-op, which all went to. It was a long-standing deal. Gallo had bought this stuff for years. Maybe some of it was going to Fry at that point, but Gallo had bought that ranch for I don't know 60 years or 70 years. Every year they bought that ranch, and. We bought it. We tore out all. We just started out. We tried to work with Gallo the first year because we took it over in July, and we had to do something. We'd had to pay for the farming costs up to that point because we weren't able to take possession. And so we had all of this Colombard, and we had all Sauvignon Vert, and we had this 22 acres of Zin Pet mix, and it was just indiscriminate. All over the place. One vine would be Pet, and then there'd be like 4 or 5 Zin vines, and it was just all over the place. I think there might have been some Carignan in there too. And it was wonderful stuff in the sense that it was all dry farmed. And so we called up Gallo and we said, "We know you've always bought this ranch. Will you buy it again?" And they said, "Sure, we'll buy it." So we waited and we waited and we waited. No contract. So pretty soon we got nervous because it had 4 acres of Chardonnay on it, old clone Chardonnay, which is the only thing we've kept from the original. It was old clone, had a lot of but it throws a lot of infertile berries.
Oh,
the
yeah.
bunches, it's Shot one berries. Of these wonderful little bunch, one wonderful mm-hmm. bunches, where it'll have like a few big berries and it'll throw this whole mm-hmm. series of tiny mm-hmm. berries and a few big ones at the bottom. It's really wonderful old clone Chardonnay. And it was getting to be around 23, 24 with no contract. So finally we started to call the buyer and he wouldn't answer. So my mother got into a sweat because we had this mortgage and we knew that the Colombard, nobody was going to take it except Gallo. And Sauvignon Vert, nobody's going to take it. But we called up Trent Dewey. This is just an old story. I mean, this is just a story of one year of panic. So we called up Louis Trent Dewey, and we said, "We've got 22 acres of this Zin Pet mix. Would you be interested?" And he says, "We come down and look at it." So he came down and looked at it, and he said, "Yeah, we'll take this stuff. We'll put it in the old patch red." So we picked it, and it ended up it picked a ton to the acre. We picked 22 tons off of 22 acres.
Wow.
And we sold it, and pretty soon we picked that, we sold it. We didn't pick it, but we signed a contract for that, and that was all that we were able to sell. The Vert and the Colombard, we knew we were going to lose it, and we did. We lost all that. And then he finally called, and he said, well, you've sold that? Well, we're not going to take any of the vert. We're not taking any of the Colombard. We're only going to take the Chardonnay. That's it. And so that was our one relationship with Gallo that first year.
That was
and
it.
So then we brought the bulldozer in, and we took all the vert, all the Colombard. We actually kept the 22 acres because we couldn't afford to do it all. So we kept the 22 acres of stuff, and we sold it to Trent Dewey. It actually ended up going to Ridge. They actually were hauling it down, I think, to Livermore. It was just one truckload, and they put it into this old patch red, and they go, please don't pull that out. And I said, oh my God, I have to pull it out. It's, you know, it's a ton to the acre. We can't make any money off of this thing.
So this Winty clone Pinot, this is, this is not the original Pinot, but it's cuttings from the original Pinot.
Correct. Yeah. What you find usually with all of those kind of deals, and what we came to notice, you know, in the '60s, nobody really paid any attention. Nobody understood what leaf roll was, for example. Right. They just said, well, some of the vines turn red. We don't know why. You know, sugar's a little lower. And what we found was there was a fair bit of variability in that original planting, but there were some really nice vines in there. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, we said, gee, you know, we should be marked. We started to mark these vines mm-hmm. with tape. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much the way that I think is the best way to improve quality, if you will, rather than take stuff over to Davis and have it heat treated, mm-hmm. get rid of all the virus. It's better to, if you can go out and find vines that are clean or that are, and this goes back to, you do get into trouble, or you can get into trouble, if you try to switch rootstocks, which is why we still have a lot of St. George. Of course, we're on St. George ground. We're up here on well-drained, rocky ground. Mm-hmm. St. George kind of likes that kind of ground, and mm-hmm. it does well in it. If you planted it in river bottom, you'd be very sorry. Mm-hmm. We continue to do that. We continue to go out and mark vines. This is what we do with the old Chardonnays mm-hmm. too, the old Chardonnay blocks. And one of the interesting things about leaf roll is if you keep a vineyard in long enough, this vineyard's been in for 46 years, there's very little, there's a lot of dead vines in there, but there's very, the amount of leaf roll actually decreases because leaf roll also lowers the lifespan of a vine. Mm-hmm. So the vines that had leaf roll tend to die off. Mm-hmm. The vineyard actually continues to get cleaner mm-hmm. as time goes on. Mm-hmm. I've tried to do that in all cases with the Chardonnay, with the Pinot. Mm-hmm. We even did this with the Petit Sirah. We went over to the Fabianos, who are very well known for Petit Sirah, and I asked mm-hmm. them if we could walk through the vineyard and if we could buy some budwood from them. And they said, sure. Mm-hmm. So we went through, my dad and I went through just prior to harvest, mm-hmm. and we marked vines. We went back after harvest. We looked at the leaves just prior to senescence. And tried to pick the best, the cleanest, because they had a lot of leaf roll in there, mm-hmm. and they had a lot of variability within those blocks. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a really good way to try to increase, you know, improve quality.
Mm-hmm. So this Wendy clone, but really, it's not a clone per se.
Not
it's,
really.
It's a
no.
selection.
It's a selection.
Yeah,
that's right.
And
that's right.
The origin of it is France, I assume, but.
Right,
but where in Burgundy
Luxembourg
you don't know.
Luxembourg is where
where it comes from.
Where Carl went.
What is it?
Luxembourg, L-U-X-E-M-B-O-R-G.
Luxembourg.
Right.
Luxembourg. That's
right.
Germany.
No, well,
I guess
no, it's
France.
It's a
no,
actually
that's
it's
a
country.
Country.
It's a country
yeah.
to itself.
Right. It's right
yeah.
next to France.
Yeah.
One
yeah.
of
yeah.
the articles had yeah. said. Actually, that's what Grandpa says. That Carl said he got it from
Luxembourg.
Yeah,
hmm. interesting.
In one of the books.
Interesting.
I have been told at one time or another that it is a Pommard clone. It is one of the Pommard clones. I have to say that if you get the opportunity to taste the fruit at harvest, it's different from any other Pinot we have. It has more flavor. They're very, very nice flavors. It's hard for me to describe what they are. I would say the only clone that we have that comes somewhat close to that is 667. But even I do believe that it is the best clone, which is why I continue. We've dallied in these other clones, but I still think it's the best. Mm-hmm. What I am trying is, and I'm still putting it on St. George. Most of it down there is on St. George. It's up on bench land in real rocky ground, and it does okay. St. George happens to be a very kindly towards displaying leaf roll. It tends not to express it. I mean, if it's not too heavily infected, it will tend to not express it. And you get into trouble if you go into rootstocks like 3309, which are very, very sensitive. A little tiny bit of leaf roll, and the whole vineyard turns red. And but I am trying. I had some bottom ground. It's real deep, heavy bottom ground, and it's just going to bud out this spring. And so I took some Riparia, which is a very low vigor rootstock. And the other thing I like about it is it's also a natural rootstock. It is not a cross. It is simply pretty much selections from what's found in nature. But it's probably juxtaposing it between St. George. It's at the opposite end in terms of vigor, very, very low vigor. Mm-hmm. But it likes the kind of soil that I've put it in. And I did put it's going to be 3 acres of Wente selections, and I'm really kind of interested to see how that turns out,
yeah,
and what the quality is going to be, and how that's going to, what effect the rootstock is going to have
right.
on it.
Right.
So it's going to be kind of fun to watch it bud out this spring.
Yeah. Are you doing the same type of program with the Chardonnay? In other words, are you holding it back and
we'll sell out, hopefully. So there will be no to hold back, but yeah. It's only 175 cases.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
Yeah.
We're pre-selling it, and it's
going yeah, very we're well. Not, we're not really, we're just kind of tiptoeing into yeah. the Chardonnay thing.
Right.
Unlike the peanut. Yeah. Unlike the peanut, yeah. Yeah. Pinot, you know, even when I was growing up and whatnot, everybody wanted the Chardonnay. And so you'd have to go, well, I got this Pinot. So if you want 10 tons of Chardonnay, you got to take 10 tons of Pinot. I mean, truly, this is what happened in the 60s. The late 60s, early 70s, nobody wanted Pinot. California Pinot, nobody wanted California Pinot. Nobody knew how to make Pinot. They wanted the Chardonnay.
Yeah.
They always wanted the Chardonnay. And we would have to bribe people, essentially, to take the Pinot. Okay, we'll take some Pinot, you know. Of course, one of the things that happened during when we went from this largely, when I was a kid, this was all the good ground was in prunes. Even some of the poor ground was in prunes. Ground like this was actually in prunes up here. Mm-hmm. It was all snags mm-hmm. by the time my dad bought it, but it had been prunes. Because even on this property, this particular ranch had no bottom ground at all. They didn't go down to the river. They didn't have, there was no water on this. But they took the very best ground. And they put it all into either prunes or peaches or cherries. The worst ground, the absolute pits, that's where they put the grapes. The worst ground went to the grapes. Yeah. But if they could find something that was reasonably fertile, it always went to orchard crops. And when I was a kid, of course, all this stuff crossed the road. It was all prunes or apples. There were some apples, but mostly prunes. And that was the crop that made the money. The prune crop was the important crop around here. The grapes were kind of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get around to the grapes. Of course, the prunes came in earlier, and then they get around. And my father loves to tell this story because at one point we did sell it to Louis Fapiano, who was also basically doing exactly what Segacio did. They were a bulk winery, had no label, mm-hmm. sold everything to Gallo. Mm-hmm. And my dad called up Louis, and he said, the Zins are getting ripe. It's time to pick. And Louis said, I don't have time. I don't have time for that. We're picking prunes right now. We're not crushing anything yet. I mean, the winery's not open. So that's a funny
story.
You know? Yeah.